Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have John Glushek. John is a managing director at Indianapolis, Indiana-based HE Ventures. John, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Christian. It's great to be here.
Super excited. So why don't we start with HE Ventures? What's the investment thesis?
So HG Ventures is the corporate venture arm for a company called The Heritage Group. The Heritage Group is a fantastic company. So I'm going to just take a couple of seconds to brag about this great, great organization we're a part of. Heritage Group is a private family-owned business, 95 years old, as you said, based here in Indianapolis. They've always had a big focus on long-term partnerships, being opportunistic, doing the right thing, and they've been able to build significant expertise over a number of different industries, including construction, environmental services, specialty chemicals, a lot of things that have to do with material science, chemistry, some of what we call today hard tech and deep tech, hard things to do. And it's really been an amazing experience to be a part of this organization. We started HG Ventures about 7 years ago as the corporate venture arm, but we were able to build a model that we believe is unique. Because of the organization we're part of, we were able to take a model that uses the best of pure venture and the best of corporate venture capital without some of the traditional drawbacks that you see with those models. Mm-hmm. So we are compartmentalized, first of all. We're able to operate like a venture fund. We don't have strings attached to the deals we do. We can be on the board. We can be a fiduciary. We can lead deals. They brought us in. They brought me in specifically to help set up that structure and that process, right? Because my background is in the venture industry. So we were able to set up a situation where we have the discipline, the structure, the discipline and the structure of a venture fund. But at the same time, now we have this amazing value we bring through the Heritage Group, really unique value added, right? You hear the concept of a value added investor from a lot of different people, right? Now, how do you do that as a venture capital fund? Where I was, you do as much as you can as a good investor to provide guidance and advice, to provide contacts, to help through processes and issues. At the Heritage Group, we layer on top of that this incredible set of resources, both on the market side and the technology side, to help companies grow. And we've already been able to do that just in 7 years. We've got many cases of examples in our portfolio where we're adding advice on product and technology. We're adding access. We're adding perspectives on the markets that these companies are going into. And in some cases, these are markets that are a little hard to understand because they're maybe not your traditional venture capital markets. So the thesis for us, for HG Ventures, we're stage agnostic within venture. We're somewhat geographically agnostic, although as you get outside of North America, we like to have local partners with us. Our check size is highly variable. We invest off the balance sheet, so we have some flexibility there. And on average, we put to work about $50 million US dollars per year. Huh? The thing that we use to filter our companies, we only invest in companies where we can help. So if you think about that, it's a little bit unique in the corporate venture world. We only invest in companies where we can help you. And we actually won't even, we won't consider it a fit unless that's true.
Okay. And will that override whether the company's pre-revenue?
We're happy with pre-revenue. We've also done some pre-product deals. So, you know, we're very comfortable with the early stages. We do like to see the team. Right, we want to see the beginnings of a full-time team that we believe is a team we want to back. And as you've, I'm sure, heard many times, that's the most important part of a business. But we've found that we've been able to add a lot of value even in that pre-product phase, right? Because we can give some of that product market fit advice in these markets that we know really well. And on the technical side, we can also help you evaluate and iterate on the technology.
I'd love to unpack founder teams with you. Before we do, I think it'd be really valuable if you can share your background with us and the lead in into HG Ventures.
Sure. Yeah. So I've been in the venture industry for 26 years now. Okay. And across all the different types of venture investing. I managed an angel group for a few years. I was with a pure venture fund for 16 years. And now I've been helping manage HG Ventures for 7 years. So I've been working with entrepreneurs for a long time. Before that, I was an engineer. I was educational training within engineering, worked there for a few years, worked in consulting for a few years, and then I got into the venture industry in 1999. And for those of you that are old enough to remember that time period, it certainly was a time of great growth within venture capital. It kind of fell off after that, and I survived. and I'm certainly happy I did, because I can't imagine doing anything other than supporting entrepreneurs and helping them grow their ideas and their businesses.
Yeah, it's crazy. I remember the dot-com boom and the impact it was seemed a ripple on effect it was having throughout the rest of the industry. Before we started the podcast, we were chatting offline and a bit unique. I also understand you've grown up in Europe. And so, you know, in addition to your engineering experience, I'd just love to know how that's influenced the way that you look at investments.
Yeah, part of my early childhood was in Europe. I was actually born in Spain and then spent part of my childhood also in England before, spending my high school years in Massachusetts. And I would say, that experience really got me used to a few things. One is just the variability of life and people and cultures, right? And and growing to appreciate that and enjoy it and really take a lot of joy from meeting new kinds of people, being comfortable in different types of environments, I think has served me really well. And my parents were always, the adventurous type when it comes to, moving around and seeing new things, and travel was something I've always, I still just love traveling. I travel a pretty good amount for business now, but even when I'm not traveling for business, my family will travel significantly to see new places and to see new people. So that served me well, especially when you think about the diversity of the entrepreneurial world, right? And all the different people and the way they approach things, the way they go about business, even in some cases, you have to be adaptable. You talked about founding teams. Maybe we can expand on that a little bit more, but adaptability is something I pride myself in being, and I certainly appreciate that in other people.
Yeah, I found in talking with people who've traveled that there's just this general appreciation for geography and culture and the impact that it has on how people conduct themselves. And so, I have to imagine that's a tremendous benefit, especially, as you look through the lens of due diligence lens, starting with founders. So, yeah, is there a profile, or do you see common patterns among mm-hmm. successful founders?
Excuse me. Let me start with the second part of that question. As I mentioned, I've come to appreciate a lot of different ways people approach things. And I've seen successful entrepreneurs of very different types, of different approaches. So I'm always very careful. And I always, when I talk to my team about how we evaluate companies, we're careful not to kind of put an archetype or some kind of mold in place, right? And say, look, we want to fit this mold, because I do believe there's a lot of different ways to be successful, and I've seen that. Okay, so I don't. We approach every relationship as a unique one, but there are some things that I would say I would layer on top of whatever your unique approach might be. And these are things that I've come to appreciate over multiple cycles of the venture industry. When you think about the ups and downs, we talked about the bubble years. The internet bubble years, but we've had plenty of other ups and downs. Adaptability is one of those things that just keeps coming through, and associated with that is perseverance. Mm. You have to have a sense of sticking to your vision, but then at the same time being able to pivot when you need to. And that's what I've seen is just really some of the hallmarks of the great entrepreneurs. The perseverance piece kind of plays out regardless of the ups and downs, right? Because even if the markets are in good shape, you as a small company, as a private company, a growing company, you have to really be aggressive. You have to be motivated. You have to make sure that your team is pushing, because you're going to run into headwinds even when the market's not in a downturn. So we have this concept of backing people who we know can make it through those times when things may not look as good. We have one company in our portfolio who went through this recently, a company called Titan Energy, based in the Boston area. When we initially invested in the company, their business model was to approach second life batteries. So they have a technology, an ultrasound technology, that allows you to look inside of batteries and diagnose batteries down to a very, very detailed level in a way that is really not possible with any other technology. Very quickly and very accurately detail what's happening inside a battery. And they initially focused on, okay, what happens after the first life application? You know, how do we figure out if this battery still could be used or recycled or repurposed in some way? That industry ended up moving very slowly, and the business model was tough within the automotive industry especially. They pivoted to focus on the battery manufacturers and realized that if you go inside the battery manufacturing floor and that process, and you start telling these manufacturers what's inside the battery as they're starting to build it, and as they're starting to generate higher volumes, looking for better yields, looking for better quality, it's a huge advantage for them. So they pivoted to that sector and have found amazing success. And they did it because the team, the CEO, the founder, were ready to change. They were ready to pivot when they realized one thing wasn't working as well as they thought they would. But that can be painful, right? It means maybe changing the makeup of the team. Maybe you're taking a step back in terms of penetration in the market. But they did it, and now they're getting rewarded.
So would you agree with the statement that perseverance is a derivative of grit and tenacity?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think people will frame it in different ways. Certainly grit is right up there. And it shows up in different ways in different forms. And it's not just the CEO, it's the rest of the team. The leadership piece of it is so important. But again, it's a really special skill that I admire in entrepreneurs, where you can say to your team, look, we need to take this hill. Here's the hill we're going to take. We're going to define it for you. We're going to try to make it as clear as possible. We're going to work together. And we're going to provide all the resources we can for you to be successful to take that hill. And then maybe the next day you say, you know what? That hill might not be the right hill. Mm-hmm. Let's move a little bit over here. There's another hill we need to take. You know why? There's because market's changing. Our advantage we have as a small company is that we can change, right? That's an advantage we have over our bigger competitors. We can pivot. We can change. Move in a different direction and say, okay, now let's get motivated about this hill and how we make it up that hill and how we work together and collaborate to get up that hill. It's really a special skill that I think the successful early stage entrepreneurs have.
I agree 100%. And knowing how challenging it can be to bring an early stage company to life, we got to take advantage of every advantage. I'd love to know, as part of the due diligence process, what does the team use as a yardstick to assess grit and tenacity?
We spend a lot of time, talking to entrepreneurs and giving them exposure to a lot of people on our team, because, when you're getting to know different people, we want to take advantage of the diversity within our team. In this case, the HD Ventures team, because reading between the lines is obviously the most important part of the process, right? Seeing how these people operate, we always want to be able to spend some informal time together. The pitch meeting is probably the worst possible environment, in my opinion, to really get to know somebody, and I'm sure everyone would say that it's a necessary part of the process. So that's okay. But once you get through that, and once you get a basic understanding, I'm talking about us as a ventures team, once we get a basic understanding of the business, of the market and the technology and some of the issues that the company needs to work through, now you can have a really good conversation about it. Now you can sit down and have lunch and have a good conversation about it. I don't play golf much anymore, but I used to do this back when I, my other venture fund, I used to, every now and then I would go out with entrepreneurs and I would play golf, and I'm not a very good golfer. In fact, I most of the time I'll slice my drive into the trees on the right. One thing I always look for is, like, do they help me look for my ball, or they just walk down the fairway to theirs? There's like little things like that. I started picking up on personalities. And it's not about me, but it's about how you treat your team. Are you going to be working together, or are you kind of a one person show when it comes to the companies you're building? So the informal time is really important, but I would say the most important thing is just making sure that everybody on our team has a chance to see and interact talk about issues, and then come together and use the power of the diversity and intellect we had, experience we have on our team, to say, is that a backable entrepreneur?
Yeah, I love it. I'm reminded of conversations I've had with my daughters over the years. Watch what the boys do, not what they say.
One of the things that I do during that process, this both the formal pitch and the informal process, is to dig into what people have learned, and press on some of those things that maybe haven't gone well, and maybe our challenges going forward, right? See how they have dealt with adversity. Mm-hmm. And have they taken accountability for it? And have they learned from it, right? Mm-hmm. And have they grown from it? Because one of the things that I don't like to see in a pitch is kind of the cover up, right? You ask about, how have the last few years gone? Or how has it gone since your last fundraise, the last time you started talking to investors? I love hearing about the challenges and the issues, the things that didn't go well, because we do not expect everything to have gone. I mean, we go through this with our own portfolio. If you tell me that everything has just gone perfectly fine over the last few years, you might lose a little bit of credibility with me, at least, because inevitably there are things that you have to work through. And what I love to hear is, here's what happened. Here's how we reacted to that. Here's what we learned from. And now we're an even better company and a better team because of that.
I think it's great counsel. I hope that our founders who are listening, they've recognized this theme that has come up, that it's okay to share that not everything is a bed of roses, because it's not. I don't know business that, you want to trend up, but it's a sine curve. And so totally fine to call out the naders, because they're going to happen. Yep. Kind of, it's a bit unique, but I'm curious. So entered the pandemic, everyone's remote. How did that force you to pivot, knowing that you couldn't get FaceTime there for a short window?
That was a really tough adjustment for me, to be clear. So, we're talking, 2019, 2020, 2019, 2020. I had at that point been, in the industry for 20 years. And up to that point, I had never made an investment in a company without shaking hands with the CEO. So, we get into the pandemic, and I remember very vividly the first deal we did, where I didn't do that. And I was scared to death. It was a very, very uncomfortable feeling. So it was an adjustment, a significant adjustment for me. Now, I had a great team around me that helped me through that. Obviously technology helped a little bit. Everybody was adjusting to it. So we knew we had to build relationships from afar. But I have to tell you, I'm still a little uncomfortable with it. I still feel like, I want to be with someone. I want to spend some time with them. I want to see how they interact with me and their team. And I've had to adjust, but at the same time, I am trying to get back to that, right? I think, coming out of the pandemic, we have been very clear that, first of all, our team needs to be together in person. Venture investing is a little bit like entrepreneurship in the sense that you need to have those collisions, right? In the hallway, in the office, you need to be able to look each other in the eye. And when you're making decisions about where you put millions and millions of dollars, that's the kind of thing that's very hard to do over the phone, even though our technology platforms are great.
So if we can expand on that, I love talking about culture, because my experience has been is that it absolutely contributes to success and failure. How do you think about building it?
So we think about building culture in a couple of different ways. One is within our team, and the other is how we interact with entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
And both are extremely important to be successful and to thrive in this industry. Within this team, we have a set of values and standards that we came up with as a team. We did this a number of years ago, and we revisit that. We think about what's important to us as a team and how we treat each other, and how we make decisions. Accountability, responsibility is a big part of that. Respect, integrity, some of the things you might say, oh yeah, well, of course. Well, you when you really dig down into it, there's important things there. We value feedback, open, honest feedback. We also value bringing conflict into the room, right? We don't shy away from that. If there are issues, we address them, and that builds respect within the team. So within the team, we have a set of values and then standards that go along with it. Standards are more about specific behaviors that we'll build, and we're very explicit with that. In fact, every Monday we have a team meeting, weekly team meeting. The first slide up there is our values and our standards within our team. Then we talk, let's talk about how we treat entrepreneurs. And this is something that is very important to me. I've spent a lot of time in this industry, and one of the things that I've been frankly disappointed with is how investors treat entrepreneurs. We have a set of values here where we appreciate what entrepreneurs do. We respect them. We treat them fairly. We provide feedback whenever we can. The appreciation and respect, you might say, well, of course, but unfortunately, the environment that you're often in is that entrepreneurs are coming to ask for capital. They're asking for money, right? So you get this dynamic where in some cases, you know, it's kind of a one-way communication. It's like, okay, you know, present to me and show me what you got and I'll give you my decision. It's not really geared towards building a relationship and building a partnership. And when you think about most venture funds, at least 95% of the deals that you see, you pass on, right? So a lot of the way you're defined in the market as an investor is how you treat those people you don't invest in. So how do you treat them? You listen to the pitch. You know, maybe you think it's not a good fit, or you don't really like it. You send them an email, or you just give them a quick phone call. Well, how about showing some appreciation for what they just did to, you know, get ready to meet with you? You might have 3 or 4 pitches a week. It could be the most important meeting that they've had that month. And you need to show that respect, because we're not here without entrepreneurs. Venture investing doesn't exist without entrepreneurs. So we're very, very careful to show our appreciation, our respect, even if it's an idea we might say to ourselves, wow, I just don't know how that's going to work, right? It doesn't seem like there's a lot of holes there. We're going to provide feedback whenever we can, and we're going to thank them for spending their time with us because we know it's valuable. And, you know, I certainly have a deep, deep respect for what entrepreneurs do. I don't have the personality, I think, to do that myself. So I admire, you know, the fact that they can take those risks, put together that vision, right? and lead these companies the way they do.
Why do you think that's more not as prevalent in the venture ecosystem?
I wish I knew the answer to that, Christian. I think it's, I my hope is that, and I do actually believe that this is happening. I think it's changing. I think that it's becoming more of a balanced field, and you know, between the entrepreneurs and the investors. But I do think that's, like I said, I think the problem is that it starts transactional, right? The relationship starts with, I need money, you have money. Okay, let's figure out if the money goes from one person or one entity to the other. That's not the best way to start a partnership. So you kind of have to fight against that. I think both sides have to be very intentional and say to themselves, okay, this is one small piece in the long-term scope of our partnership, right? Like any marriage, right? You have to think, how do I build this over time? So even when you get into things like negotiating a term sheet, right, or negotiating a deal, you have to keep in mind that, you know, hopefully if that goes well, you're going to be working together for years and years together, going through the ups and downs. You're going to have a healthy respect for each other. You're going to have to be able to support each other. So you want to be careful you don't get wrapped up in that transaction too much. So I think part of it is the nature of the beast, right, in the mechanics of what we do. But I do believe we're starting to get a little bit better there. And I think one of the reasons we are getting better as an industry is because the good entrepreneurs, they can choose who they work with. They can choose who they take capital from, and they're going to want good partners, right? So your reputation, your brand, the way you treat people, eventually comes back and helps you or hurts you, depending upon how you treat people.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, not a VC, so I don't have your experience, but you know, anecdotally, my sense has always been that by nature, venture capital business is analog. You spend a lot of time talking to people, and so it can be challenging to digitize time. Now, see, we're seeing a whole host of AI tools that are seeking to address that. But yeah, you know, for the founders in the audience, I agree. I mean, I cut from a similar cloth. I take managers really seriously, but I don't think founders should take personally, per se. I think in my sense is a lot of times it's just not, the time isn't there to do everything it needs to run the business, knowing you have to talk to people all day long. Not that it's an excuse, but so with that, I would love to know, you know, has HG Ventures started down the road of digitizing more components of your workflow? And if so, can you share with us what that looks like?
Yeah, we have. And you know, we've started testing new tools. And fortunately, I've got a fantastic team who is very comfortable with new technology. And as I really think put a lot of thought into how we can leverage that from some of the, you know, the nuts and bolts of what we do, and then into looking forward into how we become, you know, better investors. There's a lot of great information out there when we think about market insights and themes and trends and, you know, feedback from the people that we talk to. We have this combination at the Heritage Group, really incredible combination of you know, external research we can do, but then this internal set of insights, which we believe is one of the things that really sets us apart, right? We leverage that to support our portfolio with value that we don't think they can get from anywhere else. But on the front end, when we're looking at new investments, we've got people in these industries in our company that we can literally walk down the hall and we can talk to about what's important to you. What are your customers' needs? What are the key challenges you're trying to overcome? What technologies would be useful to you? What services? We want to take all that. We want to mix it together and put it together. It's something that we can action. It's a lot of data. It's a lot of data. And it's also, in some cases, proprietary data, right? Some other investors, good friends of mine, will say, hey, John, what technologies are you looking for right now? And I'll say, well, I'll let you know later, but that's actually part of our secret sauce. Is that, you know, we know what that is, and eventually we'll syndicate with good friends and good partners, and they'll find out. But looking for it is a key advantage we have, and we'll start using. We have been starting to use some of these tools to help us piece that all together. You know, for me, some basic things like, you know, taking all the research and boiling it down to what's really important for the industries that we're in has been huge, and we're starting to see some of the fruits of that.
So coming back then to due diligence, we talked about, you know, qualitative due diligence around teams. What about quantitative? You know, what are there any go-to metrics that you find that you'll leverage those insights to hone in on?
Nothing specific. We have kind of a checklist of things that we like to work through for every company, right? The basic set of things that you're going to look at. But this goes back to something I mentioned earlier about the uniqueness of every entrepreneur and the uniqueness of every company. So when I talk to some of the younger investment professionals on our team, one of the things I'll tell them is I'll say, look, don't use just the checklist when you're going through diligence, right? We are talking to companies that by definition are unique. If they're not unique in some meaningful way, then they're really not a good investment opportunity. If they're really unique, then you can't provide a cookie cutter approach to a diligence process. So yes, we'll be looking at the financial model, business model. We'll look at the customer and the competitive landscape. We'll try to, you know, we'll put together a thesis on the investment returns, right, over some period of time. A lot of assumptions involved, of course. We'll talk to as many people as we can in the market about the product market fit. Like we talked about with the team, we'll spend plenty of time with the team. But we want to make sure we zero in on what is really unique about this business. So we tend to look at our diligence process through the lens of first, what are those unique, you know, differentiators that maybe build something really big, and then what are the risks that and issues that we think would need to be mitigated over time, And if you run into too many risks that we don't think can be mitigated, those turn into deal killers. Mm. But it's really the things that can really grow and flourish uniquely that we want to spend most of our time on with the diligence. And again, because we have people within the Heritage Group who know these markets so well, we can test those different ideas with them, and they can let us know if that's really resonating.
Tremendous advantage. Your investment committee, if you can share, we'd love to know how it's structured and how you know, whether you need unanimous consent to make an investment, or is it majority rules or other?
I mentioned before that, you know, we had the great privilege to be able to set up a unique model, I believe, in the sense that we're structured more like a venture fund, but without, you know, without some of the drawbacks there, right? We don't have a fund structure. We don't have, you know, a time frame associated with a fund structure. But then on the corporate venture side, right, some of the traditional drawbacks there are having a long, drawn-out decision-making process, right, with a lot of people involved. And we recognized we didn't want to be in that mold. We wanted to make sure we could move quickly. It doesn't mean we don't do all the work. We do, but make decisions in a timely manner so that we can compete, so we can compete for the best deals. So our investment committee is small. It's five people. It's myself and the other managing director for HG Ventures. It's the CEO of the Heritage Group, the chairman of the board of the Heritage Group, and then one independent director. A small group of people, obviously, as you can probably tell from the structure, a lot of executive leadership, right? We've got the CEO and the chairman of the board. They're huge supporters and are able to provide direct input on a monthly basis. And we meet once a month to go through any investments. We have, I would call it a very traditional approval process that you would see in most venture funds in terms of kind of what's approved and how it needs to be approved. We don't have a strict kind of, you know, unanimous or majority approval. But if anybody in the room has an issue with the deal, we won't be doing the deal. I would call it a consensus building process. We can move very quickly with the structure, and we have. So we've made decisions in a matter of hours, right? Because I've got a small group of people that have the authority to do that. And as long as they have the right information, it's communicated the right way, we can actually move faster in some cases than a lot of venture funds.
So venture writ large, what's your outlook for the sector? And I'd ask if you can comment on liquidity. You know, obviously, mm-hmm. top of mind, we're not seeing the same volume of IPOs that we have in the past. We're seeing a reemergence of the secondary markets. You know, would love to get your take.
Yeah, I think we're going through a very tough time. The industry, I think, is going through a tough time because there has been such a prolonged period of low liquidity. If you look at all the data, but not just IPOs, but in terms of just in M&A and liquidity opportunities, I think it's been a longer period of time than we're used to. You know, I mentioned before, I've been through a number of cycles in my venture career, but every cycle is different. And I've given up predicting, you know, when it's going to turn back up or down or change. I think you just have to deal with the situation as it is now. And it is a very tough time because that lack of liquidity is snowballing, right? You've got situations where funds are allocating more to their existing portfolio because that portfolio needs more capital to get to an exit. You've got situation where LPs and venture funds are starting to back away a little bit because they have not seen liquidity. So follow-on funds become harder to raise, and their allocation to venture might go down because, you know, overall there's some other effects across their asset allocation. So I believe that this is something we're going to have to live with for a while. You know, I'm hopeful that, you know, there'll be an IPO window that opens up. But I think at the end of the day, there's still going to be acquisition activity. If you build a really good company, it might take a little bit longer now. You might have to get to the point where you're reducing risk a little bit more for the acquirer. But those opportunities are there, and we're seeing those. So, you know, we've actually had a couple of liquidity events this year, which I think is a little bit against the tide. And it's because we have things that have, you know, they've developed core value, good product market fit, and some other people have recognized that. But I do think liquidity is going to be a big problem, and I think it's translating into how people put money to work. We're seeing a very, very hard fundraising environment as a result for companies in our portfolio that are going out to look for new investors. And I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Got it. John, great podcast. Before we wrap up, one of my favorite go-to. If you were given the opportunity to have a conversation with your younger self, and you get to pick the age, what would you share with yourself?
Oh, that's a great question. What would I share with myself? You know, I don't have too many regrets. When I think about that question, I think about, you know, what would I advise myself maybe to do a little differently? You know, I think there's been, you know, so many twists and turns, in my life, and a lot of that has been driven by the entrepreneurs I've had the honor of dealing with and working with. And they've all created, you know, unique challenges. So I'm not sure. That's a really good question, Christian. I haven't really thought about that. I think there's a focus that I have right now, I would say, that I would maybe told myself as a younger person to focus on partnership and support. And you know, you mentioned that this a little bit maybe before the podcast started about, you know, you give before you get, right? You the way you build a partnership is that you deliver value, and then it eventually makes its way back to you. And I appreciate you and your organization taking that approach. And that's probably what I would tell myself. I feel like I've grown into that. And you hear that when I talk about, you know, my appreciation for entrepreneurs, my respect for what they're doing, my desire to support them and help them on their journey. If you have that approach and if you start a relationship that way, what I've found is it comes back at you. And I think maybe early in my career, I could have done a better job focusing on that as opposed to the kind of the tactical pieces, right, of venture and the skills and tools that you need to use and getting deals done and getting to exits. Maybe be a little more patient and take that approach of, yeah, I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you as much as I can. And if that comes back to me, that's great. If not, I'm still going to feel pretty good about it.
I love it. That's great. Great insight, and agree 100%. John, more recent question. I admit I'm also enjoying asking this one as well. If you can see any other guest on the Innovators and Investors podcast, who would you like to see? Anyone, you name it.
Yeah, well, I would love to see Steve Jobs. No, you can't do that. Unfortunately,
like an AI version of him, but I would. Let's hear why. I mean, I have an idea, but I'd love your perspective.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I admired about, you know, watching his journey and some of the things that I translate into, you know, other entrepreneurs that I see is, you know, having this ability to be innovative, to think outside the box continuously, right? Like I mentioned before, being, you know, adapting to the conditions, looking continuously at what the market's telling you, where the gaps are. But in the same time, you know, being able to run a good business from a leadership perspective and instill that sense of innovation constantly, never sitting back and resting on what you've done, always questioning, you know, are we building the best product? Should we be going into other markets? Should we be doing different things? And, you know, I actually see a lot of that in the leadership with the Heritage Group, which I'd love to mention. I think that part of the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing here at HG Ventures is because the family and the leadership at the Heritage Group has a similar type of approach. Be opportunistic. Don't just rest on what you've done. Look for opportunities to partner with people, build new things, but do it in the right way. So that's one of the reasons that I would love to sit down and talk, because what I see pieces of that in the entrepreneurs that I think are really successful is that combination of true innovation and creativity, but then at the same time, you got to run a business and be a good leader.
Love it. All right. Well, maybe someone will take a synthesis of Steve and turn it into something that I can interview, but understood. And I think it is a great perspective. I mean, it's challenging. It really is.
It is. It's hard to do.
Yep.
I admire it.
100% agreed. John, if there's any members of our audience who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Yeah, please go on our website. You can get in touch with me or through LinkedIn. I think those tend to be the best channels, and it'll be either someone or someone from our team. But we would love to hear from anybody where you feel like we can help you. You know, back to what I was saying before, we only invest in companies where we can help you with tangible value, and that's we want to make it as easy as possible for you to get to us. So I would say, yeah, the website link or through LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Again, for the benefit of our audience, John Glushek, Managing Director at HG Ventures. John, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks, Christian.
My pleasure. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. This has been another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.